Welcome in, kingly brothers and heroic husbands from around the planet. Welcome to this new episode of the Be the Husband She Brags About podcast. In today's special episode, we welcome in Wayne Boatwright. Wayne is a father, Ivy League attorney, startup techie, and someone who has served a 6-year stint for a gross negligent vehicular manslaughter while intoxicated at California's infamous San Quentin prison. Wayne left his career, wife, and 2 children behind when he arrived at San Quentin to serve his time. His commitment to take personal responsibility for his actions and to return as a contributing member of his community again had Wayne dedicate his time in prison to deep psychic introspection, self-expression, and community participation. His dedication had him become the managing editor of the San Quentin News with a circulation of 35,000 and earned over 500 days in good time and milestone credits off his 7 years, 8 month sentence. 4 months into his sentence, his wife asked Wayne for a divorce. Without being married and facing the challenge of surviving in the intense day-to-day realities of prison life, Wayne was also faced with figuring out how to stay connected with his children or give up trying to be a dad. Since his release, Wayne uses his experiences to help others and promote awareness about the true cost of going to prison. He has started his own blog detailing his life experiences before, during, and after prison. Wayne Boatwright, brother, it's an honor and a privilege to have you on the show. Thanks for coming on, man.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate that. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Wayne, it's an atypical type story. Immediately, you know, I'm glad.
Thanks for noticing. I appreciate that.
It's like the understatement. It's the understatement of all understatements. And yet, my passionate curiosity in the middle of all this, and like just why, when I read your story online on the Guestio platform, for podcasters and guests to connect in together, immediately when I read your story, it was such an easy decision for me. I guide all my, you know, when I connect out with guys, I want to have guests where I'm passionately curious and I'm deeply inspired. And it's atypical in a sense, in a very outlandish sense, in many ways, hence your laughter. It's atypical for Be the Husband She Brags About, because a core part of the story is, hey, you know, divorce happened and under deeply strenuous circumstances. I would speak it in, like, one of the most inspiring things for this for me was like just this masculine spiritual power and essence that came through and how you created a meaning, and it was so family oriented in the story to, you know, during your time there, to keep that connection with your son and daughter and beyond. However, I am curious about the Wayne Boatwright leading up to, well, quite literally the scene of the crime. Like, who was that Wayne Boatwright? Who was that man? Can you tell his story and take us into his world so we can just get a background as to, you know, just the whole tapestry of this remarkable story?
You know, I find that explaining ideas are kind of like chandeliers, so they're complex, as is a life. So trying to light all those little candles is a challenge. I guess I'd start with the fact that I'm a fifth generation Californian, which is a very rare thing on this side of the pond. And my original, my maternal line came from French Huguenots who came over in the mid-1600s. And, you know, as you age, you gain perspective of how those family ties and lines create an orientation for your life. So I had a very strong belief in the American dream and the American story, the concept of meritocracy. So I felt I could do anything if I just put my mind to it. And I was lucky enough to have the bare bones of a safe life to do that. I was raised by a single mother who had not graduated high school, with my half brother, who was 13 months older than me. And, you know, we had a really difficult time in America, which is a challenge to believe for many people. But, you know, I've lived above a gas station. I've lived in rent control housing my whole childhood. I shared a bedroom with my brother throughout my time as a child. And so that childhood was not an easy life, but it still provided me the chance to go to church and get a public education and work to become more than society expected of me. And in my case, that meant starting college at 21 and going to law school at 28 and graduating in 1990 from Cornell Law School, which is one of the Ivy League schools and a premier educational institution in the United States. And I think that is probably just as unique a story as what happened to me after my crime. And please know, I do consider it a crime. I attempt to honor the sacrifices that were made unwillingly, both by my victim, her family, and my family, because of my actions. But I'm going to try to call it an accident from now on, because it was also an accident. It wasn't something that I ever imagined I would do. And that is a pivotal point in my life. There is no doubt. As is marriage. You know, you mentioned the show for husbands. I think the value of being the hero, you can also have cautionary tales, right? Not just tales on how to be better, but what not to do. I could provide a little of that, you know?
Yeah, some of the greatest inspirations for myself of guys coming on were, you know, it's when you can vicariously learn through the hard-earned spiritual journey of another man. You know, the spiritual path, it's pain that carves out the true character of a man. But you know, the beautiful thing of your story, and I'm loving actually getting to know, you know, the backstory, this incredible, beautiful autobiographical tapestry of your life. But yeah, it's like it's not to lose the potency of your life's experience. I think so many guys listening in, and I know we'll probably go into, you know, the use of alcohol and that, and but it's like we live so much by default, stuck in our heads, so busy. You know, so many guys, like in this line of work, I'm seeing, like, there's, you know, there's addictions to sedate the unfelt pain, etc. And of course, alcohol can be one of those major ones, or drugs, or porn addiction, etc., etc. So, you know, to be able to vicariously learn from a man that, like you, that has paid, well, as close to the ultimate price, you know, as a man can, but has weathered the storm. I think there's profound spiritual wisdom to be harnessed by me and every single man listening in. And I'm just really appreciating your leaning in and sharing so intimately into your story, Wayne. So
absolutely. My pleasure. I will say, if you want to use this terminology, is that I've graduated from marriage. Maybe that's a way to characterize it. I would also contend, you know, and I the concept of co-parenting, marriage is a gateway for me to be a parent, and a structure to allow you to become a parent. And so the concept of being a co-parent with my ex-wife and the mother of my children, to me, is literally as important as being married itself in many ways. And so that new terminology we're using in the United States of co-parenting is something, again, I like your terminology of leaning into it. I try to lean into that and be the best co-parent I can with my ex-wife. And you know, to give you a quick little anecdote, I think I had mentioned it. You probably haven't recognized this, but I've had 27 different jobs in the 4 years since I got out of prison. You know, you're disbarred as a lawyer, so I can't practice law anymore. And I take pride in being able to take care of myself. And so one of those jobs, I'm house sitting right now for a friend who's gone away to Burning Man. And they don't want to leave their house empty because they don't want any robberies to occur. And at the same time, I'm going over to my old house that I had bought with my wife in 1998 to looked after my daughter's cat. So I have a key to my old house, even though my wife has remarried about a year ago and has a new life. She still trusts me as a family member to look after her house while she's away at the same time. And I think that's a testament to our co-parenting respect for each other and part of an important relationship, especially husband and wife relationship.
Yeah, Wayne, you gave us a beautiful, it felt like a first half or like the real foundation of, you know, your life growing up with your beautiful mother as a single mother, supporting and parenting yourself and your sibling and getting through immense challenges growing up in your early family life, but emerging actually to carve out this incredible American dream, as you said, that belief in meritocracy, where you could come from those challenging childhood times to emerge, if you want to say, within the system victorious, you know, graduating from Cornell University. It felt like the first half of the bridge of the story, the tapestry of your life. Can you fill in the gap between, you know, graduating from Cornell University and, you know, that lead up between graduating and that lead up? And what were the main experiences that you had that ultimately ended up with you as a man, you know, being so deeply intoxicated that you were driving down the wrong way in a highway?
I hear you. You know, I've always been a curious sort, even today. I still continue to take great effort and pride in learning new things. I was practicing law. I had planned to go to DC and do international law. My mother and brother were having some severe challenges, so I ultimately went to LA when I got out of law school. And I'd been working there for 2 years and got my family situated and raised my head from that very intensive law experience and realized I wanted more. So I actually ultimately went to Seoul, South Korea, and worked as a foreign legal consultant for the dominant law firm in Korea. I was in Korea for 6 years, from 92 to 98. And when I say dominant, the law firm is called Kim and Chang. They generate $1 billion in revenue now. I mean, that's bigger than virtually all the US law firms that exist. It's a very, very big law firm. And I got to become a superstar in Korea. I got to tell you, I partied with Stevie Wonder one night. I met George Soros. I met Michael Bloomberg. All kinds of different, the King of Norway came. I mean, it was unbelievable the people you could meet when you're working as a foreign legal consultant in another country. And I would contend that that opportunity probably did more to prepare me for the prison term to come than just about anything else. You know, when you're in a foreign country for a long time like that, tourists don't really get this, I don't think. It's very difficult to dance in step with the culture you're involved in. I think the way to say it is, you know, you have to basically look in the mirror and say, wow, I'm not in Kansas anymore. I'm in Korea and they do things different here. I got to remember how they look at personal space, what they consider appropriate conversation topics, how to deal with the hierarchical language versus our English language, which is much more of a horizontal language. We all talk to each other as in the same tense. And in Korea, you have literally six different ways you can communicate with somebody else and use different verb structures depending on your relationship to them. And so understanding that was quite a challenge and thrilling for me. And I loved that time there. And I ultimately wanted an even bigger stage. So I took a global position with a company called Accenture, which is a publicly traded consulting firm. I actually helped us set up our Irish subsidiaries that we were reincorporating as we got ready to go public. So I was in charge of the internal legal structure. We were involved in about in 56 different countries and over 200 legal entities. We were getting ready to go public. So I got to travel all over the world and work for Accenture before I got caught. And I was living in the Bay Area, right? I came here to take that job. So I moved to San Francisco in 98. And, you know, it's interesting. I got bit by the startup bug. So from my time at Accenture until my crime, I was basically helping a myriad of different startups in different industries try to capture some of the magic of these new technological opportunities that exist as we've created this digital realm that has made information, you know, limitless, frictionless, and free. And so how do we take advantage of those opportunities? So I guess from a career perspective, that's the way I'd say it. I got married to my children's mother, Joy, and I'll try to only use her name there. I try not to use names when I'm doing podcasts. I proposed to her at the handover of Hong Kong in 1997. Where the British were giving it back to the Chinese. And so I thought that I wanted to do a once in a lifetime event to match up with my proposal because I only planned on getting married that time. Of course, it hasn't turned out that way.
Since my marriage transformation myself, I've regained some part of the old romantic part in me that was shamed growing up. I just love that. I love the conscious part of you going, hey, let's get this once in a lifetime event in your life tapestry, but to join it with this historical event is like, wow, that's just beautiful.
I love that term tapestry. Yes, I think one of the things my mantra, what I say to myself is that I refuse to know for certain what everybody else takes for granted. Because my crime and my prison term and my divorce, I equate to burning down this psychic delusion house I had built up over my lifetime, or maybe another way of saying it, the tapestry that I had woven over my lifetime. And I think we forget, we don't appreciate that we can time travel and the past is not permanent like we think it is. Because in my past, I was only going to get married for life. And I had to go back and reweave that story when it was shredded by divorce. And recharacterize that experience. That's a painful process to go into the past and have to do that. But the tapestry has to be whole or it won't sustain us. And so you have to do that. And that was a big part of my journey of introspection and we call it the work in prison, to prepare yourself to come out a new man, to re-enter society, you know, to end this thought. I say re-entering because the sad truth is I do not feel like I have fully re-entered society as yet, that process is still ongoing, and I don't know if it will ever end.
Take me actually on a practical basis here, Wayne. When did you re-enter society in the sense of, you know, when what was the date of your release?
I got out in February 2019.
Okay.
And luckily I got myself situated, and then COVID hit. So you might say that I had another house arrest for a while, much more comfortable than my time in prison, I'll be honest.
And there were a few billion serving the same sentence with you. So it was a little bit of a shared load. So the beautiful proposal in 97, you come back to San Francisco, the startup bug, you're playing you're having a fun time in just going with the unfoldment of tech startups at the time. And what was the lead up, you know, coming from there? How did that man, which from the outside and in many senses, like as you said earlier on in this, Wayne, you know, you're living the American dream. You're a man of, and I know we can go into this in a deeper philosophical way, and I imagine we will as we get into your prison experience and that beyond. But like from the American dream perspective, you know, Western society, you know, you were a man that made good. You came through the tough times early on. You carved it out. You went to the top, you know, as you say, like you were like sort of like the superstar in the Korean scene, and coming back to San Francisco with your bride to be and getting married, etc. You had it made, you know, you're on a level from the outside, you're at the top. How, like, did you feel that you were at the top, or was there some part of that story, some undercurrent that you were aware of that, you know, you weren't tending to, that would have ended up leading you to, you know, the unfoldment of how things went for you?
Sure. Yeah. The process of introspection and studying your own life, as you well know, the idea of a persona, right, that we adopt to present ourselves to the world. There's no doubt that the persona I presented was one of success. In fact, many of my friends presumed that I was a trust fund child, not knowing I had grown up on government cheese, which anybody who's had public assistance in the U.S. will remember that they used to give us 5-pound blocks of what is basically Velveeta cheese as part of our supplement for being unemployed. That wasn't the way I appeared in the world. That wasn't the persona that I presented. What I've learned through my hard, long journey of introspection and self-discovery is, you know, we all have blind spots. The reason we need to be social beings and have the vulnerability that can be uniquely possible in a marriage, for example, or in a family, is to have others help point out those blind spots that we have of areas we just are, it's impossible for us to see. For me, it's the curse and the blessing of my success, I think. I always told myself, my old mantra used to be, I had to be better, faster, stronger than anybody else. And that included hiding, even from myself, many of the challenges and insecurities and difficulties that I was saddled with or was experiencing at that same time. So I think the way I would characterize it is, I could never have been successful enough with the orientation that I was living, that I was living through and projecting. And because I had to be better, faster, stronger, I couldn't talk to anybody about it. I couldn't admit it, not even to my wife. And so I sought the solace in a bottle. You know, I really hadn't drank until I was 33, to be honest. I came from a religious background where drinking wasn't accepted, and so I wasn't a drinker. And I was living in Korea, And alcohol is a very critical component of business in Korea. You take people out to dinner, you drink at dinner, then you take them out to a bar, and then you go to a karaoke bar to show your emotions by singing. And these are standard steps. And I got into the habit in Korea of joining that process of drinking. And I think that habit opened the door to the alcoholism that ultimately led to the loss of my victim's life and the destruction of two families.
Was the point at which you recognized you're an alcoholic, was that the point of the accident, or were you actually aware how much alcohol had sort of come in upon, you know, your psyche as a man before that?
Not consciously. I was a functional alcoholic, right? I had a career, I had a family, I was a deacon of my church, I was a Sunday school teacher. But when I look back on it, you know, when you're drinking alone, that's a sure indicator that you might have a problem. And I was drinking alone more and more often and daily. So now when I look back on it, it's obvious that I had a very bad problem. Then I thought it was just some bad days that I had. So even if they were brought to my attention, I would discount that and not take it that seriously, because I didn't know how to deal with that. I couldn't face what that might mean, because I had to be better, faster, stronger. And of course, that mantra came from a, you know, I would characterize it now as evidence of my own inability to feel a sense of self-worth. So I had to justify who I was to the world, rather than just accepting that as every human being, my feelings are valid and my emotional state is valid. I would never share those, not even with my wife. And I think alcohol was one way I could self-medicate that reality.
And I think feeling into it, I feel every single man can relate with that. You know, whether or not you know, a guy listening in uses alcohol, I know my experience of alcohol, Wayne, was back in college days. I did the opposite of you. It's like growing up in Ireland, I mean, the self-medication of alcohol is like, that's just, it's not called self-medication. That's just having a good night out. You know, it's like we call it here. Oh, are you coming out to have the crack? That's the Irish slang for let's go get pissed. And I remember having a distinct unfoldment in my college days where it's like in the beginning it was like all fun. Yeah, you know, I'm only drinking because I'm having fun. But there was this savage, slow but sure savage awareness coming off. There was this pit of emptiness. And, you know, I was caught up in the midst of, you know, it's like 9, 10 pints of beer, and then you hit the shots at the bar, like, you know, it's like you were drinking to astounding levels. But because 90% of like people in on the Irish college scene was there, I think it was like mainly all 99% of the Irish, and then there were some foreign exchange students looking on going, oh my fucking god, like this is like a train wreck. But like that was just that was just a regular night out. But I could look back and go, the reason I knew, like for the last year, if it was, I'm just hiding all of this shit down. And the more I drink, the more depressed, the more, you know, there were suicidal thoughts coming true. So I at some point realized, thankfully, you know, I realized, and my journey has been ultimately, I think it's like the last, what, decade and a half or two since, but I have had my first hand experience, albeit sort of like chronologically coming at opposite ends. I leaned in really heavy early on, in a very destructive way. So I can join you there in that human experience of, you know, the sort of bittersweet. It's like sweet because when you drink and you get into that high, yeah, it feels much better. but just that hiding away from the pain underneath. And from reaching out to, you know, countless guys around the globe now with guys listening into the podcast, every man has a story of that. So it's such a beautiful opening into your life. And it's one thing I actually, when you were sharing there, Wayne, and I really wanted to be fearlessly intimate with you, I actually was overcome by like a wave of grief that was coming through me. And it's, I really wanted to share it with you and like why that was coming up, because I'm so glad that we have like just slowed down here at the beginning, like the, in this beginning portion of our conversation together. My grief, Wayne, was getting to know the human you, the down-to-earth fucking human, the man that, man, came from a childhood, had, you know, the beautiful sacred experiences, grew up, fucking jumped into the, you know, the race to success that we're bombarded with, made good. But you were just having like a simple human experience as a man, you know, like with your inner demons, without the without the tools, like every man listening in, and that's what I'm trying to do with this podcast. But without those tools available, you were doing your 10 out of 10 best to just live a good life, without, you know, the toolbox of self-awareness tools that you would have placed upon your path. But unfortunately, you had to have that accident, you know, that was part of your spiritual journey. But I really wanted to share one heart from one man to another. There was that wave of grief of, wow, you know, that could just have easily been me, you know, early 20s. Like, I'm in no position. There's a line in Christy Moore, he's an Irish musician, very popular, but in a line of one of his songs, it's only the very safe can talk about right and wrong. That wave of grief just came. It's like, it's just so beautiful to connect with the human center to you. And yes, we will share more on the prison story and the accident. But yeah, there's just a heart of love here, man. Just feeling your human story and what you, you know, ended up getting involved with on your life's path.
Mark, thank you. Thank you for saying that. And I appreciate the opportunity to participate in a forum that might be heard and hopefully help others avoid getting to the end of the path they may be on, as I was. There's no doubt I rode that path to its most tragic end, not for myself, for my victim, for the two families that I destroyed. And I say two because my children were 5 and 7 when I committed my crime, my accident, and 6 and 8 when I went to prison. And I didn't get out till they were teenagers. And I missed a large, I missed half of their life. But it's more than half, because of course this first 3-4 years I don't really remember. I feel grief for my past self and all that past self lost, and that I live with as I try to reweave that tapestry that I shredded with my actions. So I appreciate you noticing that and giving me a venue to talk about it. You know, I find many podcasts look for prison porn or crime porn, as the way I characterize it. And that isn't the central part of my life. It pivoted my life onto a new, you know, orientation or new direction. And I accept that. And I try to do the best I can with the cards I've been dealt now, if you want to mix metaphors. But I don't complain about the cards, you know, that's what you're dealt. The question is, how do you play the hand, right?
Yeah, I love that. And I really, you'll feel like the most beautiful things that happen in this podcast form is like just what's happening now. And I do invite guys in, like to intimacy and like into me, you see. I love that's really simple definition of it. It's really, you know, every guy listening in, maybe some guys have done prison time. Maybe who the fuck am I to make any comment like that? But statistically, I believe, you know, the vast majority won't relate directly with that firsthand experience. Yet I'm quite sure, you know, most men listening in will have, you know, that one time when, hey, you might have hit somebody, or one time when you cheated on your wife, and or one time, you know, it's like, I feel the life story of for every man has moments, maybe many of those moments and significant moments. But I really love indigenous tribes where it's like they would never judge a man's life, a man's character on one moment. Never. They just would not do that because they knew, you know, it's the whole, I'm using the word tapestry as suiting this conversation. It's the whole tapestry. In preparation for this call, when I actually meant to check it out, there's the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. I got into Buddhism in college, and I've remained deeply grounded with that as a beautiful spiritual philosophical stance or viewpoint in life. And but there was one famous master, I think going back centuries, but he created havoc and destruction. Like, he brutally murdered countless people, and he went on to transform in the spiritual fire of Buddhism, you know, to transform all of that pain, all of that resentment, that suffering, into becoming one of the most famous masters in the Tibetan Buddhist lineage. And I just, that story like really came back up as I was grounding into this conversation today. It's like, Mark, you know, you've got to meet Wayne, but like meet him with a heart. And I just was deeply inspired with that story and going, well, hey, Wayne has this incredible story. And what I'm witnessing thus far, and I think every guy listening in, is like there's that feeling of heart-centered wisdom that's coming true. Wayne, you've given that beautiful human context to, you know, the lead up. The accident happens. No need to go into commentary on that. It happens. We've got the lead up, inner demons, etc. You have full awareness retrospectively. You didn't have it at the time, and it happened. Take us into that window between the accident and you coming to terms with, like, what the fuck is just after happening, you know, with the reality that was, I imagine, rapidly unfolding around you. This has happened. I can't change that. But what does this now mean for my life? Tell us the story of that window between accident and actually finally going off to San Quentin.
I had about 17 months between the accident and actually turning myself in to go to prison. But I'll be honest, I was severely injured in the accident as well, had to be medevaced as well to a hospital. So I spent 90 days in a hospital bed on a morphine drip. And then my recovery was long and slow. So, you know, wheelchair for 6 months, then a walker, then crutches, all of which, because of my wealth, I could do from home because I could afford bail. And many of the men that end up in prison have to languish in a county jail until their crime is adjudged and they're sentenced to go to prison. I was able to do that from home, and I'm grateful for that opportunity, but not everybody has that. But that time was one of organizing my life and taking copious amounts of morphine. So it was very fuzzy for me. It wasn't as integral in my life story. or I didn't create as many strands of thread to weave into my tapestry during that time because I was medicated, legally this time, but very heavily medicated over that. I found it also essential. I knew I was going to go to prison. I did what was called a plea bargain, where I accepted a set sentence rather than having to go through the formal adjudication with the judge and jury, because I committed the crime. I wasn't going to waste the state's resources to try me in open court with the hope of getting a lesser sentence. I had to take responsibility for my actions. And one of those ways is to serve sentence. And I was ready to do that. I used that time to create as many positive stories as I could with my young children and with my then wife, in the hopes of preserving our marriage and giving them a foundation to understand what was going to be happening in a very short while, that I was going to go to prison. For example, I know baseball isn't that big in Ireland, but you know, it's one of the top three sports here in the U.S. And my son and I bonded over baseball. And that summer before I went to prison, we didn't just go to as many baseball games as we could. We got to the stadium 2 hours early and went to batting practice. And he had a glove out in the outfield in the stands with the hopes that he would get a ball. And he still has in his room probably 10 or 15 baseballs that he got from those batting practices where we would go early, when he was, you know, again, at that time, only 8 years old. And so we were able to bond over baseball, just the two of us, and to, you know, practice fly balls and getting grounders and hitting and all that stuff that a father should do with his son. And created patterns. When I finally did get out, it was cold and rainy in San Francisco, but the first day my son was back from school, he wanted to take me to the basketball court and show me he could shoot three-pointers. It was raining. It was outside. He still wanted to go show me that he could shoot three-pointers. And so that foundation served us very well to preserve our relationship. It kept it safe in many ways, even though I was in prison and even though he could visit me in prison. As a final point, you know, a lot of guys don't have their families visit because they're too embarrassed and they know it's a hardship on their families. But I worked every lever I could to get sentenced to San Quentin, this infamous prison, because it was the closest to San Francisco. And I wanted my family to visit me because I knew that personal connection was essential. I can still remember a day we got an orange out of a vending machine just so my son could throw it to me and show me the six different grips he had for pitching. You know, you can't have balls in the visiting room, but we would stand there and he would practice his pitches with me with that orange until it got soft and mushy.
I'm again just leaning in, and I want to be real. Unfortunately, we don't have the videos on of tearing up, just breathing through a rapidly forming lump in my throat as you were telling that story, because I was really just putting my nervous system through. It's like, if that was me with Elena or Anya, you know, my beautiful kids, and like, hey, one moment defines so much. So thank you for sharing those sacred stories. Wayne, obviously the story goes, you eventually entered San Quentin. What was that entry like? You know, I think most guys, we've looked at, you know, the classic manly, masculine movies, you know, the depiction of Escape from Alcatraz to the Shawshank Redemption, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so we've seen it in the movies, we've seen it in shows, but what's the firsthand, what was your firsthand experience? Like, when did it really hit home? You know, how real it was, that life on the outside and life on the inside, that, like, was there one moment in that entry journey that just, like, really let your nervous system know, like, it's now happened?
It just with your question, I'm realizing that my prison journey, which is the same for anybody in the United States that commits a serious crime or a felony, has a ratcheting process of three different steps. You start off by turning yourself into county jail. And then when you leave county jail, you go to reception, where they mix all the new inmates and decide where they're going to classify them and then where they're going to send them to the permanent or long-term prison they're going to go to. And you find at each of those levels, you gain a better understanding of just how different the world is you're entering. I think two ways I would try to give you some insight to that. One is you have transported yourself to the savannah, where everybody is either predator or prey. And you better make sure they don't think of you as prey if you want to have a safe time in that prison. In this case, you start off in jail. My jail was super crowded. We had triple bunks in a, they had cells, those were all full. And then in the common area, they had triple bunks along one wall with people in them. And then half of the floor was covered with mats on the floor for more guys. So the space had at least 3 to 4 times more people than it was designed for. And you spend most of your time making sure that you can all live together. When can you use the bathroom, for example? How do you go to eat? When do you use the yard to get some exercise? All of those things dominate that experience. And when you go to reception, it's with the hardcore criminals, because you go with everybody. And the reception I was in a city called Wasco, it was a modern prison, so everybody had a cell, but you rarely left your cell. You were on what was called lockdown for at least 23 hours a day, because there was so much violence that occurred as people were trying to establish a new hierarchy and their pecking order within that hierarchy. The guy in the cell next to me had a broken jaw as he was trying to establish his hierarchy. I saw guards use what are called block guns to shoot people that were mobbing an inmate who wasn't from the right gang. And block guns are like, it's like shooting a weighted tennis ball from a shotgun. It knocks you down. In another part of my wing, a guy was killed because, again, he wasn't appropriately aligned with the gang structure inside of that that reassignment or assignment center. And then at San Quentin, you went through that whole process again, but with more free time, more time in the yard. So I think that the most sanitized way of describing it, if you know the movie Wizard of Oz, which is very old and most people don't know it, but there's a point where Dorothy is looking in the mirror or looking at her dog Toto and says, "Toto, we're not in Kansas anymore." And recognizing just how alien the world she had entered was, with flying monkeys and witches and wizards. I would say that prison was a similar shock to the system. Luckily, I had lived in other countries, so I was used to going into environments that I didn't understand and was much more open to different values and the way to communicate and to survive and ultimately to thrive in that prison environment. So even though I was known as an educated man, and I went into prison, I was basically 50 years old. So I was an older man, but I didn't have, I had created a way to keep myself safe in there and did so very effectively over my time in prison.
I'm really curious at that point. The skill set, the social skill set you referred to earlier, you know, in Seoul and just that, you know, alien culture and that mental skill set that you developed there, How did you keep yourself safe? What was it that, you know, allowed you to navigate that world? And, you know, in your bio, you went on to be the managing editor of the San Quentin News. You carved out a deeply meaningful path throughout your journey there whilst keeping safe and keeping out, I imagine, or you can clarify this, without getting embroiled into the depths of, you know, the gangs. What did you do, or how did you pull that off?
Not the way most middle class or rich people who went to prison did. There were a few of us in there that had come from the same social class. Most of them, as a contrast, most of them I called ATM machines. And they kept safe by buying loyalty, giving gifts, allowing people to use their items that they were able to purchase inside prison. And I called them ATM machines because people would come and they'd stand in front of that ATM machine and plug in some numbers. And nobody wanted anything to happen to that ATM machine. But you kept getting longer and longer lines in front of it. So I knew that wasn't a path I wanted to go down. The path I went down was to create connection and then create value for the community that I was in. And creating connection I'll get to this, but the last day I was in prison, they wake you up very early, like around 4:30 in the morning, and you leave before virtually anybody else gets up in your dorm. I was in a dorm of 200 men for 6 years for most of that time. And in that dorm environment, it's a very open environment. And so I was grateful to be up early because I had to throw away 2,000 packets of Kool-Aid. Now, before you think about, well, what are you doing with 2,000 packets of Kool-Aid? What I had done to create connection and show value, you can't give people things. You have to trade. Everything was about trading with people so they have some self-respect. So I told everybody that I loved the lemon Kool-Aid that they would give us in our lunches. The lemon Kool-Aid was fortified. So it had vitamin C and vitamin D. Vitamin D is one of the few vitamins humans produce because of sunshine. And in prison, you don't get a lot of sunshine. So they supplement the Kool-Aid. So you want to drink the Kool-Aid in prison, believe it or not, because you need that vitamin D supplement and the vitamin C supplement to keep you on a healthy, you know, balanced physical life. So I, when I saw guys, you know, and they wanted my cookies that I didn't need to eat, I would trade them my cookies for their lemon Kool-Aid packets. But I had to hide them because obviously I didn't need all these Kool-Aid packets, right? That was just an excuse. But I showed them that I was valuable and that I respected them because I wanted to trade with them. I wasn't going to buy them anything. But I would do unique things. There was one of the most powerful tools I had was twice a year, you're allowed to order from a mail order catalog that to buy different items. And as you can imagine, you know, both sweet and savory are central cores of those catalog items, things you can't buy in prison. And so chocolate was a big deal. So if I was trading for something and was going to give somebody chocolate, I wouldn't just buy them chocolate. I'd buy them a jar of Nutella, which these guys had never had in their lives. I wrote a story called Nutella is Manna from Heaven. That must have been what God meant when he talked about manna, because it is the most perfect sweet in the world. You can put it on anything and it will taste better. It's the best chocolate I've ever had.
You would want to know the family man you're talking with. My beautiful wife is Italian, and like whatever the hell like Nutella has got in, that it's like it's the Italian breakfast. It's like that they literally, but it's like we've went through different phases where, you know, I am trying to optimize so many different parts of my life and trying to go sugar free, and she's like, Mark, I've tried going without Nutella, I just can't fucking do it. I need my Nutella. So
yes, yes. And try to imagine sharing that with a 30-year-old man who's spent his whole adult life in prison and has no idea what Nutella is. You earn loyalty that way, but yeah, you're showing respect because it's a trade. It's not a gift. The only thing I would do is, you know, many of my, you ask about what was the realization. I think the biggest realization wasn't necessarily who I connected with inside. It was realizing that I had become a ghost to my peers and my outside community. And I would haunt them irregularly, right, with a phone call or with a letter. And they weren't quite sure what to do with me because they knew I was alive, but I was so isolated that it was analogous to being a ghost in their lives. And that haunting wasn't always welcome. You might call at an inopportune time, but you've only got 15 minutes and you might only get one call a week. So that's a valuable time. And not everybody recognized that when you would try to get a hold of them. So it's being a ghost. But when my friends wanted to give me money to put on what's called my books so I could buy things, you can buy things once a month from the prison commissary, where the average markup is about 65%, according to one of our recent San Quentin news articles. So it's expensive stuff, but you can buy stuff like, you know, I could have a pint of ice cream once a month, right? That's it. You don't get it any other time. So you could buy that. But I told them, no, don't send me any money. Send me a subscription to a magazine. And so I would get subscriptions to magazines that I would never read. People, Us, Sports Illustrated, Mechanics Monthly, I don't know, sports and, you know, outdoorsy magazines, stuff like that. And I would keep those magazines by my bunk and I would let people borrow them. And so I was valuable because I had magazines these guys wanted to read. And because I was from the modern world, I'd let anybody do it, not just my race. In California, regardless of its very progressive politics and perception, its prison system is probably the most segregated prison system of the 50 states in the United States. And I'm saying that from experience. Again, I was the managing editor of the San Quentin News. I've worked with many other state prison systems. They are more integrated than the California system. And so many of the inmates in the California system interact almost exclusively solely with their race, basically being Latino, Black, White, and there's a catch-all category called Other, where immigrants would fit into that, for example. But I let anybody read my magazines, and I'd buy Kool-Aid packets from anybody, so I gave everybody that respect, and that's a way of keeping safe. I was valuable to the community.
It's so fascinating. Because it's like it's at the core of human psychology, and I even draw, there's like these beautiful life lessons in how you were thriving there under what are, you know, exceptional circumstances on one level, but, you know, being valuable in the world. You know, many people live in the prison of their own mind and they don't know how to get rid of struggle and suffering. You know, it's like I'm curious to know your thoughts on the prison of the mind, you know, in your deep introspective healing journey. But it's that those life skills that you use to thrive. It's like, how can you be of value to the network, the social network around you? It's actually grounded life wisdom, it, irrespective of in prison in San Quentin. Of course, it's like life and death. If you get that right, as you said, you know, there's that context, you know, predator and prey. How can you just not be the prey? But beautiful life wisdom there. Wayne, one of the most important aspects of this, and, you know, guys listening in, the vast majority, you know, listening in are husbands, but they're also, the vast majority are fathers. How did you know, from kicking off in those sacred, beautiful, sacred moments of connection that you've already, you know, invited us in with your son and with your daughter before, that you planted those powerful seeds beforehand. But how did you keep that connection going forward? And as you know, especially within the context of 4 months in, your wife sends you the divorce papers, and that was like a spanner in the works. And how did you keep that fatherly connection going for the duration of your stay? What was the greatest challenges you had to overcome, and how did you overcome those challenges?
As a foreshadowing, I have overcome those challenges. I have a very intimate and close relationship with both my children, so much so that my daughter introduced me to her boyfriend this summer when he visited from Baltimore, and we went out to lunch together. So much so that my son and I text each other virtually every day today and communicate various topics. At the time, they were very young, and you have to meet them where they are. And when you're in prison, that's much more difficult because you don't have insight into where they are. You're not living with them. You have this little keyhole that you're peering through, trying to guess what's happening in their lives and what what they're doing. And so you do the best you can with the tools you have. For me, for example, both my kids were early readers, and my daughter fell in love with the Harry Potter stories and read all the books. And so I took it upon myself to go to the prison library and read all the Harry Potter stories. So I'd have some common ground to communicate with her about the things that she cared about. And so I would try to incorporate what she would say about her life with an experience from, the Harry Potter universe. And I found that to be a very effective tool to allow me to share something with her. Something as simple as sharing, playing a game of Uno cards in visiting, sharing a snack. That sharing is essential and has to be, by its very nature, as intimate as you can make it, given the circumstances you have. And I worked very diligently to always take advantage of the opportunities, rare though they may have been. My ex-wife, to her eternal, my eternal gratitude for what she has done, she kept visiting me with my children during my time in prison. And so that ability to connect with them and share things with them was greater than with most of my fellow inmates who didn't have those opportunities. So that sharing is essential, and finding meeting them where they are and finding something to share with them. I also found it was important to reach out for help. You'll be happy to know I have an Irish Catholic saint that I still give veneration to. That's right. I do. She, her name's Elizabeth, and Elizabeth, her son and my son were going to school today. Now she's got four boys. And she reached out to me when I went to prison, and we had a regular correspondence when I was there. And she helped me buy birthday gifts and Christmas presents that were unique and were shared from Dad. And without her help, I'm sure my relationship would have been much more tenuous than it ultimately became, because she knew those important milestones and events and rituals had to be kept alive. And she helped me do that in very innovative and creative ways. So Elizabeth, I will thank her forever for allowing me the opportunity to stay connected to my children and going out of her way to help me do that.
You know, the major thing that's just startling for me in this conversation, Wayne, is number one, it's I'm feeling like the exquisite preciousness as you tell these stories of those opportunities that you know, the necessity of the scenario, of the situation. It just, like hyper focused your mind and your heart to be completely present and just be so intimately present with your kids. And it contrasts so much of the human experience out there, which we have it there on tap. You know, our fucking kids, they're there in the morning, they're there in the afternoon, they're there in the weekend, they're there, like they're there. And there's, and our wives, you know, those nearest and dearest. And yet it's like there's this epidemic worldwide of men not being exquisitely with their kids, exquisitely, you know, placing their time and attention and getting that. And I do know it's like, you know, the exceptional circumstances, but it's just, it's jumping out of me, you know, when you, the power that you said, hey, you know, when you started answering the question was, you know, I have overcome those challenges, Mark, you know, you have this beautiful experience with your son today, you're texting to and fro, you know, your beautiful daughter introducing her boyfriend, you know, the such a heart opening with you. And I'm deeply inspired. I'm in awe, and I'm really, as a dad myself, I'm like, I'm up in my game as a result of listening to you. Genuinely, it's just this story. Like I've been in tears or the background, I tears at the back of my eyes, experience listening in. And I just so want guys listening in to vicariously get that point and ask that question of themselves. It's like, you know, how are you using those opportunities? Like Wayne had to through necessity, but yeah, I really wanted to intimately share, Wayne, you know, what's happening in me as this beautiful conversation unfolds.
Thank you, Mark. Again, thank you. That's a kindness that you've given me that I appreciate. It's not, it may not be that obvious, but I'm actually much more of an introvert. I'm just good at pretending to be an extrovert. And so having you say that encourages me to be more open in sharing about the journey I'm on and some of the tools that I've developed and used. You know, I had mentioned the better, faster, stronger component. And one of the main things I've learned is to be willing to ask for help. Even more important, to be willing to say yes when help is offered, when it's unbidden. Because again, we all have blind spots and may not realize where we need help. One of the ways I've shown myself worthy of trust, because that's what the kids perceive, you're going away as destroying. How can they trust you? You've abandoned them. They were 6 and 8. That's the way they would process what was happening. And so to regain that trust is a lifelong challenge. It doesn't end. My daughter goes to boarding school. So even though she's in high school, she goes to school in Connecticut. And she has a cat named Milky Way. And when she goes away to school, I have Milky Way stay with me in my one bedroom apartment. And I take care of her cat. And I send her a Snapchat, you know, a photo, literally every day of Milky Way, so she knows Milky Way is okay. And that's a testament for both of us, because it shows she trusts me enough with this precious pet that she's had most of her childhood, and that I appreciate how important that pet is to her by sending her a photo and letting her know that, you know, Milky Way is purring and she's safe and she's fine. And by the way, I'm not a pet person. Okay, it is a commitment that I'm making solely for my daughter and to earn her trust and to show I'm worthy of her trust, that I won't abandon her ever again. You asked some of the most difficult things. There were, I mentioned some of the close communications with my son, and you know, we'd have rare chances to talk on the phone in prison as well as the visits. But those aren't easy. You have a bank of four phones, kind of like the old pay phones that we used to have, that are next to each other. And there's a big sign that says, please keep your hand out of your pants when you're on the phone. So you can imagine what a lot of the phone calls near me were like, and also how everybody would listen. You know, you mentioned the modern world in a way and how isolating many of us are with our families, and we're in our own little world. The modern world doesn't realize that people who come from the street, shall we say, listen to everything. They hear things you don't. They see things you don't, because you've trained yourself not to. Like, I would consider it impolite to listen to somebody's conversation on a phone a foot away from me, but they don't. They listen to your conversation. So you have to be very careful about what you say and what you share. So it limits your ability to communicate. So I found the best way I could ask for help was to write a letter, as I did with my friend Elizabeth that I mentioned, who is my Irish Catholic saint. And she's also saint because she has four boys, which I can't imagine what raising four boys must be like. She is amazing. Another woman who trusts me enough to house sit when she's gone. So I'm grateful to get the vacations out of my one bedroom apartment and take care of her place. Anyway, I was going to say that asking for help's important. A story that you can find videos on. I did another podcast with an organization called Man to Man, which teaches fatherhood values to the incarcerated. And as a side, I'm going to introduce you to Stuart and have you suggest that you invite him on the show to talk about his work and his experience at trying to teach others about fatherhood who come from a culture where of abandonment. You know, over 70% of the children, of the African-American children born in the United States, are born to a single parent, virtually always their mother. And so it's a real epidemic here. And so these guys don't have the tools to be a good father. And so,
that's beautiful. And I love just the conversational nature of it. If you can make that connection, it's any man that has just went through life and has harnessed the life lessons from it spiritually and consciously and brings it together, we love having on this show. Wayne, you mentioned about, you know, reaching out for help. A core part of the culture that I'm building here at Be the Husband, she brags about, is like the core part is like there's no honor in wearing the badge of lone wolfing. Ultimately, it's like we all pay the price for that. Our families, our marriages, parenting, and society as a whole. You mentioned doing what you call in prison the work, and I looked at a beautiful movie of the same name, of deep men's work being done in prison. So I'm curious to know a little bit more in the time we have. What was the main work you did introspectively? Was there, take me into what the work was for you at its core.
Coming from the atheist, educated, tech elite, I've learned to specialize in many ways throughout my career and throughout my life. And I made it a project. How the hell could I be this person that could do this act? And what can I do to make sure I never do it again? I think what's different for me than most people is the power of that effort at introspection and understanding myself was driven by one of the most powerful forces that exist. And it wasn't marriage, and it wasn't faith in God. It was murder. I took a life. You think you know what power is? Take a life to understand what power is and the responsibility such power should engender, that you know how to control it. If not, it will control you, whether that's addiction, or focusing only on your career instead of your family, that will control you. So I had this immense power that I had not even recognized that I could have. And so I was lucky to be in San Quentin, not just because it was close to my family, but because it has the most volunteer groups that volunteer time and hold regular meetings, probably of any prison, again, in the United States. California is progressive, but the Bay Area uniquely so. And so we have close to 150 different groups that hold about 300 weekly meetings, some from organizations you've probably heard of, like Al-Anon, NA, AA, but also some more specialized ones, like Nonviolent Communications, Guiding Rage into Power, GRIP. The one that had the biggest impact on me was called Vogue. So it was a victim education, a victim offender dialogue group that basically was an 18-month small circle group. So again, I know you're going to give a plug to the groups and calls that you have regularly, but I highly recommend anybody listening to find something like that. I call it the circle because, you know, you normally would sit in a circle. And the power of the circle was what allowed me to take off the armor that I had developed to protect myself, some of which, of course, I didn't even know existed. I had developed when I was a young child to protect myself from the harm and trauma I felt as a child, and have honest discussions about what our crimes were and take responsibility for those crimes. And then be able to articulate that in a way that might help others on that process to heal from becoming victim and perpetrator into becoming a survivor. And that group that, again, it lasted 18 months, we'd meet about 2.5 hours a week and then have homework assigned outside of that as well. It culminated in a victim panel. So they invited in the families, four different families who had victims taken away from them by crime. One of those families, for example, was a mother who lost her son on his wedding night when he was slain in a gangland shooting. One was a mother and a daughter who had lost their father to a drunk driver, very similar to my situation. And to sit with those victims and help them process their crime and guide, wear the black hat for them of the person who had done this, and let them know that you were a person and not just the crime you had committed and the work you had done to take responsibility for that crime and to learn how to make sure you never would commit that crime again, can allow those victims to stop staying in a permanent state of victimhood and become a survivor. Analogous to having a wound heal, it leaves a scar, but it should heal. Now, I'm afraid many, many people in the United States, whether they are perpetrators or victims, that wound never heals. They stay in this permanent state of victimhood. And you need to let it heal and become a scar so you can have a normal life, a full life. And that group was the most powerful for me, and the opportunity that allowed me to really have the courage and develop the tools, as you mentioned, to explore my plumbing, shall we say, my emotional plumbing, and see if I could either repair it or reconnect it or create new components to it and allow my full self to be expressed. Because I, as I'm sure you know, most of the abnormal behavior, whether it's addiction or violence, that people do, is driven by the fact that they have developed defense mechanisms against some personal trauma, but those defense mechanisms may have shut off a part of their personality or a part of themselves. And in seeking to reconnect that, they might relive those things. If they were beaten as a child, unconsciously, they may beat their children because they're reliving that experience. And part of that is because you have to learn to face that experience as an adult, not as the child who experienced it. Grieve for that child, yourself as a child, and recognize that, and then be able to process that and integrate it into your personality so that you don't repeat it on the next generation. Because unfortunately, that's the normal pattern. There was one family that had three generations in San Quentin, son, father, and grandfather, all in prison, perpetuating that cycle because they hadn't learned to deal with the trauma they had experienced. And so they replicated it on their children.
Yeah. It's the astounding fact of psychotherapy, of all of these awarenesses of how we hand trauma from one generation to the next. We inherit a trauma pattern in our nervous system and we don't even realize it. But as you say, like one generation after the next goes to prison. You know, why does the alcoholic, does the son of the alcoholic mom or dad become an alcoholic themselves? It makes no sense rationally. It's like, clearly you've lived through the pain of it, but it's the pain undealt with just brings it back. And again, spreading that into what we did, the work here in Heroic Husbands Men's Circles, it's undoing that pattern. So I'm loving you bringing that clearly out, the human factor. And that has been a core part. Circles has been a core part of your beautiful human transformational journey. Wayne, there's this part of me, and I think you can feel it. It's like there's this part where I wish I was your next door neighbor, and I think we'd meet up like for an infinite, never-ending string of coffees together, where I would just pick your brains and just I'm just loving the embodied wisdom and your story and wanting to know more, to have you share more. However, within the beautiful time space reality that we live in, we'll come into landing. The last part of the jigsaw, and you nodded and bowed to it earlier on, is, you know, the returning citizen. I'd love to hear your human story behind what you were pointing to when you said you don't know if you've returned yet, or like, will that process ever be complete? Take me into what you were meaning by that inner world human experience of coming from prison life for so long and coming back into re-entering society.
You probably heard the term becoming institutionalized before, and it is an embodied experience. When you spend year upon year in a state of hypervigilance, as you must do in prison to stay safe, you develop these embodied habits that are very difficult to put down once you get home. You're not allowed to sleep a full night in prison. The guards do their rounds every 2 hours or so. And they jingle a set of keys as they go around. Not to be malicious, but to let you know they're coming and you better stop doing whatever you're doing that they shouldn't see, or they're going to have to do something about it. So it took me a couple of years just to learn to sleep again and get a full night's sleep. It took me a couple of years to be able to be comfortable in a crowd, because all that noise was always the time of the most hypervigilant that you had to be when you're in prison. And so you don't feel safe in a group. And regardless of what your rational mind says, I was at a fundraiser for my daughter's school after I gotten out, and I had to leave halfway through the dinner because I just couldn't take any more of it. And that takes years to unlearn that embodied experience. But I think the biggest challenge is coming from, again, the the atheist, secular, educated elite, there is no path to forgiveness in this community. Most of the people in it have had a lifetime of success, so they don't know how to deal with the failure that my crime and imprisonment represents. And so when I appeared back in the world, again, I was like a ghost that was haunting them. And, you know, you had mentioned your own experience with alcoholism. I'm sure a big part of that is for the people who had also in the past driven when they shouldn't have. And I reminded them of that. You know, religion provides us a path for redemption, but many people have lost their faith. And so the language and tools of forgiveness and redemption don't really exist in their whole form in the educated elite society that I came from. And so very few of my friends, I mentioned that I'm house sitting for a friend. She's happy, she trusts me implicitly, she's happy to have me house sit. But she doesn't invite me to her birthday party, for example. So those types of isolation, of feeling like a ghost, are still very present in my life. And I don't know if they'll ever end.
Oh, it's the grief comes up for me. It's that line, only the very safe can talk about right or wrong. It's just ringing in my mind and heart here. Having sat with you for this beautiful, intimate conversation, I don't flippantly use it. It breaks my heart that, you know, you can't practice your career, because, like, what the fuck is that about? You know, like, again, in a heartless society, you know, one moment we pretend to define a man, and then you're kind of working that. And it brings up a grief for me of, I speak here about the profoundly sick society. It's G.D. Krishnamurti's way of saying it's no sign of success to be, you know, completely fitting in a profoundly sick society. And we're not going to get to the bottom of why society is the way it is. I've speak to it in many different episodes. Like, coming into landing here, Wayne, in my heart of hearts, I wish that the members of society that have been through the spiritual fires and know what pain is. Like, you know, definitely in this culture, there's just, from me, and I know guys listening in, like the wholehearted and deepest honoring of your path to your truth, of the spiritual pain that you've been through, and I know you still carry that responsibility, and you carry it so diligently. But there's just love and honoring from me, and I know, you know, the guys that listen in, they know this is how we roll here. No man listening in, you or any other human, should ever be defined by one moment in life. It's just, I don't think it's the spiritual wave. So, but you know, it's very revealing, not of you as a man by my perspective, but of the society we live in, that, you know, that's what you're facing as you re-enter into society.
Well, we all have our challenges, right? I don't begrudge anybody their grief, because without challenges, how else could you find out who you really are? You think you know who you are? You have to face those shattering challenges to really understand who you are, and then decide if you want to become more than that, different than that, and then take action on that. That's the journey of life. I think, on a positive note, if you don't mind, I've mentioned connecting with my kids often, and it's very important, and asking for help. My daughter wanted to be the first space veterinarian when she was young, and so she would explain to me how much she found it fascinating about space and space travel. So I wrote a letter to a famous astrophysicist named Neil deGrasse Tyson, Have you heard of that name? He's on...
I have. Yeah, I know the guy. I've listened to a couple of his talks. Very good guy.
Great guy, right? Amazing. So I found out he was, he's in charge of the Natural History Museum in New York City. So I got the address of the Natural History Museum in New York City, and I wrote him a letter from prison, you know, explaining my situation and how concerned I was to stay connected to my kids' life and how I wanted them to learn STEM, especially my daughter, and be motivated by that. And asked him, you know, if he had suggestions on what I could do as a public figure to keep her inspired that way. And much to my shock, he wrote me back. Neil deGrasse Tyson wrote me back and made some suggestions and talked to me. And while I was in prison, he wrote a book called Letters to an Astrophysicist. And he wrote me and asked if he could include my letter in his book and wanted my contact information after I'd gotten out. And when he was on book tour in San Francisco, he invited me and my daughter to come to the green room an hour before the show and spend a private hour with him as he was getting ready for his show about this book, Letters to an Astrophysicist. And so she got to spend she was around 13 or 14 at the time. She got to spend an hour with Neil deGrasse Tyson, who she had seen on TV, talking about her career plans and astrophysics and space and all of those things. That's why she named her cat Milky Way, for heaven's sakes, right? So she got to meet Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he was so impressed with her bright and engaging personality that he asked her if it would be okay to invite her up on stage. And so she went up on stage and had a 4 or 5 minute discussion with Neil deGrasse Tyson about her interest in space and journey and her experience. And it's wonderful for her, but it was wonderful for me that I could reach out and ask for help and have it heard and have it be responded to in such an amazing way as this very busy and very famous man to take his time and share with me and with my daughter. And it was very important that she know that her dad loved her that much and that he was trying his best to be the father she needed to have. And Wayne, hopefully that she could trust me, you know, in the end.
Wayne, what a beautiful high note to end this astounding conversation. This is one of the most astounding conversations I've had in my life. I'm not just going to say the podcast here. I've been astounded to the profundity, to the depth of the spiritual power and genius and creative capacity that you had to carve out this character and this beautiful story with your children and beyond that. And undoubtedly, the unstoppable force that you connected with within yourself in your time in San Quentin will bode very well for you going forward. You're an amazing man, Wayne. Wayne, guys that are listening in, that are curious to know more about your story, I know you've kicked off your blog, but where can the follow up online? And I will have the links in the description. So where can guys follow up with you?
Sure. Thanks for that. I would first suggest if they want to know about prison life and the possibility of restorative justice and reentry, they could read the San Quentin News, and it's just sanquentinnews.com. And easy to look up with a Google search. And there's about 60 to 80 articles every month that are posted that they could read about all the different groups and all the different steps that men are taking to try to be worthy of reentering society and being a value to their family and to their community. So the San Quentin News is great. I post most of my stuff on Medium, which is an online publication, and I've written close to 100 pieces about this journey that I've been on various facets and topics of it, as I've learned to see the world. And again, I refuse to know for certain what everybody else takes for granted. So I ask a lot of questions that I explain my journey to trying to find an answer. And much to my surprise, the world's a very different place than I ever thought it was, or that society teaches us. You mentioned society being sick. I think that's absolutely right. So there's many things we don't recognize, that sickness. And so I think I've worked hard to better understand that, and then to find a way to express that. Because that creative self-expression is essential in anybody's recovery. And then service to share. You know, I consider our call a form of service, not a PR campaign. If there's anybody we could help to get off the road where addiction leads, or get off the absent father or the lone wolf, I would hope our conversation could give them an inspiration and the courage to change that path.
Wayne, it is without doubt that every single man listening in, if he's alive at all, if he has had more than one neuron alive during this call, which I'm quite sure he has been encapsulated from beginning to end, like I have in my position here, deeply inspiring. Your entire example, and on so many different levels, every man is it's life-changing to just have had the honor and privilege of hearing your story so intimately. Thank you so much for coming on, Wayne.
Thank you, Mark.
Kingly Brothers and Heroic Husbands from around the planet coming into landing, like, it's wow fucking wow. You know, we talk about masculine spiritual practice and coming home and, you know, reclaiming our authentic truth and what that means within the octagon of marriage. And, you know, it's to lean in on Wayne's example, under the most exceptionally testing and challenging circumstances that we might never fathom possible. And, you know, it's the hope of all hopes that you don't have to learn it the same road that Wayne went. But Wayne, if Wayne is able to carve out such a character and such a story of massive parental victory and spiritual victory to come out the far side, well, what is possible for you and what is possible for me? So coming into landing, definitely a beautiful conversation that serves the core mantra and purpose of our movement. Better husbands today, better world tomorrow. Go have an amazingly beautiful kingly day. And before you go, Kingly Brothers, I'm so happy to let you know that Heroic Husbands Men's Circles waiting list is now live. Online meetings supporting you up level to hero husband status. Go from fearing your best will never be good enough to becoming the competent and confident husband she brags about. Save years of needless guesswork and confidence eroding disconnection. Click on the link in the podcast description to take your first simple step to becoming the marriage-transforming hero of your relationship. Check it out now.